I got 2 hours before the last study.
Okay, today let's continue discussion of lesson 15, personal pronouns, related adjectives. So we'll finish this up today. And we talked in yesterday's lecture at the end about the fact that the gender of your relative pronouns here, personal pronouns, is going to be consistent with, have concord with the antecedent. By antecedent we mean the thing in the context that the pronoun is referring back to. See, the fact that you can use a pronoun indicates that whatever the thing is referring to is sufficiently understood by the context so that you can use a pronoun. And so that thing, whatever it is the antecedent. It's the thing that is being referred back to. In many cases that antecedent will be addressed in the previous few verses or sentences. But in some cases it may go all the way back, you know, if it's been a long narrative about somebody or something, and he did this and he did this and he did this and he did this. If you open up and look at one passage, you may not know what the antecedent is unless you go all the way back to the beginning of the narrative. Now, we looked at section 106. We didn't quite finish the examples here. But here we see instances in which the personal pronoun may be translated it, even though it's masculine or feminine. Other instances in which it may be translated him, if it's neuter, for example. And the one we looked at, Luke 1:59, Ekalun auto Zacharias, they called him Zacharias, when in reality it's a neuter form of the pronoun here, but it's referring to paideon, which is neuter. And Echen autas tromos, trembling seized them. Now the interesting thing about the word them here is that it's feminine. And in the context of this passage, it's referring to women that were at the tomb. And so it uses a feminine form of autos. Now if you're using referring to a mixed group, men and women, you'll use the masculine form. And if you're using a masculine, referring to a masculine a group, of course you use a masculine form. The feminine form isn't used that much by itself because it's not very often that you have a group of women only that you're talking about. Here's one example. And holukos harpadze auta, the wolf snatches them. Now here the auta is neuter, and it's referring back to sheep, which is a neuter noun, and the plural form is ta probata. So in the context, it's referring back to sheep, and the them here is neuter now because of that. Okay, so that's just something to double check and keep aware of, that in the Greek, you may see masculine forms, feminine forms translated as it. You may see neuter forms translated as him sometimes, and them and so forth. It's just going to depend on English idiom and how English idiom is going to relate the idea. But the only caution I give is don't read personality into something that's not necessarily there. Okay. Section 107. Now we'll take a look at the first and second person forms of the pronoun. Autos was the third person form. And that's the form you probably see used most commonly just because of the nature of the New Testament. The New Testament is a narrative about, you know, at least the Gospels are narratives of historical events. And most discussion in print like that is using third person. But in quotations and so forth, you may see first person, second person used, and in conversations and this type of thing, and there's quite a bit of that in the New Testament as well, so you'll see these other forms. The paradigms of the Greek pronouns of the first and second person, singular and plural, are given below. Now let's take a look at these paradigms and notice some things. There's several unusual features here. Let's look at the first person singular, first of all. Ego is the form for I. And that's a bit unusual for a thing that's functioning like a noun. We haven't seen anything with an omega ending except verbs. And so this is maybe a little bit unusual. Then the genitive form has two possible forms, emu and mu. Now, emu has an accent on it. Mu has no accent. There's a term for words that don't have an accent. They're called enclitics. And we will talk about enclitics a little bit. Well, I'm going to take an interlude in section 108 here and take a look at that appendix on those, just so you'll see what the accent problems are with enclitics. But we're not going to require you to memorize all that information on the test. There's just a lot too much detail to worry about. But there's two forms, emu and mu. Now, about the only distinction we can make between the two forms is that as we go through the rules, there will be certain preferences in some instances for the accented form or the unaccented form. But aside from those details, the general idea is the accented form has a little bit more emphasis than the unaccented form. And that stands to reason. There's just a little bit more attention drawn to it when the accent's on it than when it's not. Okay, so we have two possible forms. These both mean my, mine, or of mine. Depending on the rest of the syntax, primarily depending on whether the thing it's attached to has the article or not. And we'll look at that again a little bit later on, further down. Emoi and moi. Okay, omicron iota, that's a little bit odd for a dative singular that we've seen. In fact, I don't know if I should say this or not yet, but I guess I might as well say it. Some of these forms are looking more like third declension forms. These aren't purely third declension forms. They're kind of hybrid forms, period. But some look kind of like second declension, like the genitive singular, and others look more, especially the plurals, look like third declension forms. So the best thing to do is just memorize these forms as they are. And these things are used so frequently that it's well worth the effort to memorize them. So we have two forms, again, one accented and one unaccented for the dative, emoi and moi. And then for the accusative, it's emme and me, with no accent. And of course, the emoi, the dative form means me, to me, or for me. In other words, if me is functioning as the indirect object or object of a preposition that takes the dative case or something like this, that's the way it'll appear. And if me is the direct object, then it'll be emme or me, accusative case form. Now looking at the plurals, I think I'll go ahead and take the plural next of the first person. First person plural, well, maybe I shouldn't. Maybe they number them a little bit differently. Well, I think I'd like to look at it anyway, just to see the continuity here. It's hemes. Hemes is we, nominative. Hemon, good old omega nu, that's something you can always count on, no matter how strange the paradigm is. Omega nu in the genitive plural, ours, of ours, of us, our, so forth. The dative hemin, iota nu, that's a rather typical third declension ending. although we haven't gotten to third declension yet. Us, to us, or for us, and then hamas, alpha sigma, for us as the direct object. So that's your first person singular and plural form of the personal pronoun. Then the second person singular. Yes, question. Mm-hmm.
Is there any reason they have an exit form?
Well, I can't give you any philosophy behind it, except that very often these things are stuck right on. For example, moo, the genitive form, they'll stick it right. Having an unaccented form means that the word that it's attached to forms one accented unit with that word. And these things are used so frequently that there's a tendency to shorten them up and just stick them on. It's almost as though they're becoming endings. Not really, but you'll see as we've done some reading, and perhaps you've noticed in the reading already in John, the word mu being stuck on and with no accent, it just kind of flows in with the rest. And it's about the only thing I could say. If you break it and put the accent on it, it's like it breaks the flow and draws your attention to that. So things like this, these pronouns are such short words, and they're intended to streamline your language anyway. I think the whole idea behind it is to get things as short, simple, and streamlined as possible. Other than that, I couldn't give you anything.
Will they use them about as equal, or will they tend to move in there?
You mean the accented versus the unaccented form? I would say the unaccented form is probably, at least with the first person singular anyway, that's probably by far the most common. But usually you see if one thing is more emphatic than the other thing, the thing that's more emphatic is going to be less common. Because if it was more common, it wouldn't be emphatic anymore. You know, kind of lose all your emphasis if you're just saying it that way all the time. It's like these books that preachers write, you know, they get really excited about it, and everything's in capital letters, you know. You know, they stress everything, but pretty soon the whole thing is capital letters. Now you don't really stress anymore. Okay, you're almost relieved when they quiet down a little bit, you know. Okay, second person singular form is su, just with a upsilon, and that's the nominative form now of the second person singular. In other words, if you wanted to say you did such and such, then you'd use su. Now, I should say this, the nominative forms are probably not going to be seen as much as the genitive, dative, and accusative forms. Anybody think of a reason for that? Why would you not see the nominative forms as much? Mark? Right, exactly. In the verb, see, if the verb contains the subject idea, so in these pronominal usages, you're not as likely to see the pronoun written out in the nominative case form, unless you've got a predicate construction or something like this, because the verb already has the information. If you do see it, though, pay a special attention to it, because it's very emphatic then. So you can use it, but it's not needed. These other forms you're likely to see number-wise more often in the text. Especially, I would say, the genitive form. That's probably the one you'll see the most often of all of them. Okay, so the genitive then is su or su. Exactly the same form, varying only by the accent. Meaning, of course, is the same. Just a difference in emphasis. And don't confuse the sound is the same. Su versus su, the way we're pronouncing the diphthong omicron upsilon. Then dative, soy and soy, one with the accent, one without, and the accusative, se and se, one with the accent, one without. So at least you can compare the two paradigms for first person and second person singular. They're both rather unusual, but they're the same unusualities, you might say. Now the only thing you have to watch out for, well, I guess it's consistent. All the way through in the first person forms, you have an epsilon as the first letter. Ego is a little bit unusual in that you've got a gamma instead of the mu, as the rest of the forms do. But the endings are the same, except for the nominative here. Okay, then the second person plural, humes, humon, humine, humus. Notice if you compare this with the first person plural paradigm, they're identical except for the eta versus upsilon. Eta for first person, upsilon for second person. Other than that, they're just the same. And these forms you will see quite frequently. Of course, you want to make sure you know the difference between the you and the we form. Okay, any questions on these paradigms or the meanings of the meanings of the words here? I guess the meanings are going to be clarified in the next couple sections, because there we're going to be dealing with using them. But they're just exactly like our toast was as a personal pronoun, except they're first person and second person. Okay, Tony?
little confused on when it's got like the definitions for the dative and the accusative. They're both me or you or you.
Mm-hmm.
As far as going from English to Greek, the other direction.
Mm-hmm.
Is it just because of is it just like other words where you're, as you're building your structure, you make sure you use the right case just to
right.
match what's in the sentence?
Right. Now, in other words, let me give an example here. Let's suppose we had a sentence, he gave you the book. Okay. Now, he gave you the book. How would you analyze the word you in that particular sentence grammatically? What would you? What part of speech would you call it? Yeah, it would be indirect object. Indirect object in this case. He gave you the book, or in other words, he gave the book to you. Okay. The book would be the direct object. Now, in another sentence, suppose he loved you. Okay, now you is the direct object. But in English, the word you is the same. I mean, there's no difference in the form you as a direct object or as an indirect object, except that as an indirect object, we can often add to you to make it clear. That's the reason why, you see, he says you, to you, for you, so forth. And then in the accusative, it's you also, or the Old English. It looks the same, but it has to do with how it's functioning in the sentence. So what you need to do is, in a given English sentence, if you're going from English to Greek, identify how the you is functioning there. Is it direct object or indirect object? That'll determine what case it'll be in Greek. Okay? And then from Greek, of course, back into English, you may translate an accusative by you, or you may translate a dative by you, depending on what the English idiom fits. Okay, any other questions? Okay, let's look at section 108, and I'm going to take a little bit of time to look at that appendix, just so you'll be... Have had exposure to this enclitic accent pattern. The forms without accents in the paradigms above, and that is in the first, second person, singular, genitive, dative, and accusative, are called enclitics. They have no accent of their own, but affect the accent pattern of the preceding word. The details of this are discussed in Appendix 1. For the present, it's sufficient to point out that the accented forms are usually emphatic. Minor differences in the functions of the accented and unaccented forms are noted in appropriate sections of this lesson. So as we go, we'll have him make statements here and there with regard to which one is most prominent in, or whether they're interchangeable or whatever. Now, let's take a look at Appendix 1, if you will, just for a moment. And I don't mean to add a whole bunch of detailed information here, but I think it might be good to look at this to see what kind of accent patterns are entailed by these enclitics, and there's another thing called a proclitic also. Back on page 326, in the back of the book, we'll just take a quick look at this, not for the purposes of trying to get this all down and memorizing and so forth. As I've said, we're not going to be memorizing these accent rules necessarily as far as these details are concerned, but it would be good to go through it, know where the information is, so that if you're ever in doubt about it, in a given instance, you'll know what the situation is. And in your reading, you'll see funny things. You'll see things, I think somebody pointed out earlier when we were reading, that a word that had two accents on it. That's covered right here in the situation that occurs there. So the section 400 here deals with proclitics and enclitics. Now, we haven't talked about proclitics yet. There are things like, we've seen some, but we haven't really talked about them. Forms like ho and hey and hoy and hi, the nominative forms of the article that don't have an accent, just a breathing mark, are called proclitics. And they usually don't have to worry anything about. They just don't get an accent. They don't affect the accent of the following word unless the following word happens to be an enclitic too. So let's look down at section at number 3 here. It says the enclitics are, and list the forms of the words that are enclitics. First, the forms present indicative forms of ami and phemi. So these are me verbs we haven't gotten to yet, but. The verb to be, ami, is unusual, and many of the forms are enclitics, don't have an accent. Then be, the forms of the indefinite pronoun tis or ti. We haven't covered that yet. We will cover that later. And then si, that's what we're on right now. The unaccented forms of the personal pronouns, mu, moi, me, su, soi, and se. That's where we're at right now. So these are the ones we're most interested in the present time. Then there's other things, indefinite adverbs, the conjunction te, the emphatic particle ge. We haven't looked at those things yet either. Now, rules for accenting enclitics and words followed by enclitics. A, when a word accented on the ultima is followed by an enclitic, it retains its accent and the enclitic receives no accent. So, ho, hu, yosmu. There's an example. We have the word huios has the accent on the ultima, last syllable. When that occurs, then if an enclitic follows it, the enclitic doesn't get any accent, and you just leave it as is. Ho huios tu adelfu mu. Okay, there's again the accent on the ultima. Adelfu mu is no reason to put an accent on the mu. Theoi esta. Okay, again, the accent on the last syllable, and esta being an enclitic form of the verb to be, doesn't have an accent. Okay, then B, when a word having an acute accent on its penult is followed by an enclitic, it retains its accent. And, number one, the enclitic if monosyllabic receives no accent. Two, the enclitic if disyllabic, meaning two syllables, receives an accent on its ultima. Acute if the ultima is short, circumflex if it is long. Okay, so here's a little bit more complications now. If the word that you're dealing with, the word that comes just before the enclitic, has an acute accent on its penult, in other words, a syllable before the last, then there's no accent on the enclitic if it's monosyllabic, if it only has one syllable, like mu. But if it's disyllabic, then there'll be an accent on the ultima of that enclitic, and that accent will be determined by whether it's long or short. Okay, so ho logos mu. There's logos, the accents on the penult, and since the enclitic is monosyllabic, there's no need for an accent on it. But look at the next example. Ho theos agape estin. Notice the accent now on estin. You can normally estin wouldn't have any accent, but it's got the accent on the penult now, and it's an acute accent because the penult happens to be short. Haute estin. Haute estin he Angalia. Angalia. Okay, haute estin, again, accent on haute is on the penult, and estin is disyllabic, so it's going to have an acute accent on the last syllable, but that's changed to a grave now because of the next word following. So you've seen that already before. Okay, then there's an example, meta presbyteron tinon. There is a circumflex on the omega nu simply because, again, we have an accent on the penult of the previous word, and this is a disyllabic enclitic, and so it get and the last syllable is long, so it gets the circumflex. Okay, I'm going through these fairly quickly because I don't really want to spend enough as much time on it to try to memorize all of this, but just to have some familiarity with what you're looking at, so it won't all seem so strange. Then C, if a word with an acute on its if a word with acute on its antepenult or with a circumflex on its penult is followed by an enclitic, it receives a second accent, an acute on its ultima. The enclitic receives no accent. Okay, so this is what we ran across in the text a couple of times. Look at anthropostis. Anthropostis. We have two accents on anthropos. One on the antepenult and one on the ultima. And no accent on the enclitic. And the way to think of this, perhaps, is if the accent is way far forward on the antepenult, you need some kind of accent near the enclitic to get any kind of a punch in that area, as it were, and any kind of an emphasis. And so, since the enclitic doesn't like to take the accent itself, especially monosyllabic ones like this, the ultima of the word itself takes it. And the same thing happens when you have a circumflex on the penult, because remember, that's as far forward as a circumflex can go. And so ho dulosu. It's hard to pronounce that word with the same stress on both syllables, but you just kind of tail it off there with a su. It doesn't get much accent. Anthropoitines and duloitines, same situation. Then D, when several enclitics occur together, all but the last have an acute accent. The last receives no accent. So if you line up several enclitics together in sequence, they all take an accent, an acute accent, except for the last one. So aner tis estin. Notice tis has the accent, but estin doesn't. Estin's the last. Both tis and estin are enclitics, but estin's the last one in the series. Humes philoi mu esta. Notice mu now has an accent and esta doesn't. Okay, then E, when an enclitic follows a proclitic, the proclitic receives an acute. So A tis. Now A is normally a proclitic, it's a conjunction, and it takes an accent now. Normally it doesn't, but because an enclitic follows it, it takes an accent. Got to have an accent. Somebody can't get too many words without any accents at all. It's the basic problem. And then F, exceptions to the rules for enclitics. And now we get our exceptions to all of this. And there's only two major ones here. Enclitics may receive an accent when they begin a sentence or clause, or more generally when they follow a mark of punctuation. In this position, estin is accented estin. So when an enclitic begins a clause, follows a punctuation mark, or begins a sentence and so forth, it will take the accent. And I don't know if we'll read the examples here. And then part two, after Allah, A, Kai, U, Tuto, and Hos, the forms of Ami retain their accent, but Estin is accented Estin. So we get a shift in the accent and the retention of the accent after these words here, Allah, A, Kai, U, Tuto, and Hos. They're all kind of, it's kind of a grab bag of words here. They're all kinds of different categories here. So that's just an exception to it. But that'll at least give you some familiarity with the nature of enclitics and proclitics and what happens to them. They're little words that don't get any accent by themselves usually, but they do affect the accentual pattern of the word before them in the case of an enclitic and the word after them in the case of a proclitic. Okay, don't worry about memorizing those rules by any means. But when you're reading and you see two accents on a word, or if you see no accent and a shift, a different accent in the previous word than you expected, that's the reason for it. Okay, back to section 109. Now to take a look at how these first and second person personal pronouns are used in a given context, it's pretty much the same as what we've already seen with autos. So, section 109, like autos, the pronouns of the first two persons have syntactic functions similar to those of nouns, except that they do not have the article. So just like autos as a personal pronoun, ego and su do not have the article. Okay, number one, the nominative case forms may function as subjects. All right, John 6:35, ego eimi ho artos tes zoes, I am the bread of life. So ego here is functioning as the subject of the sentence. And su e ho huios tu theou, you are the Son of God. There's su, the nominative form, singular, functioning as the subject of the verb a. Hemes nomon echomen, we have a law. Notice hemes now is in the nominative case, functioning just like any other noun would function in that case. Humes katharoi este, you are pure, you are pure. Now, one thing to notice here, that in every one of these examples, because the pronoun is stated here when it doesn't need to be, in other words, you could take off that word in boldface in all of these and still get the same translation exactly. The only difference would be that with these pronouns, there's more emphasis. And if you look at each one of these contexts, you'll see that there's a reason for emphasis. Ego eimi ho artos tes zoes. Jesus said, I am the bread of life. When he's saying that, he's putting a stress on I am the bread of life. And the ego eimi, you see, is taking you right back to Exodus. And so there's a very definite reason for the emphasis here. Rather than just say eimi, which would be normally said for I am, he says ego eimi. And su e ho ho yos tu theou, you are the Son of God. You are the Son. There's an emphatic declaration here. It's not just, you could just say a, but it's su e. And hemes nomon echomen, we have a law. You can just see the Jews saying this. We have a law. By his law, this law, he ought to die. You know, putting the emphasis on their law and themselves. And hemes, you are katharoi eser, you are pure. So there's a greater emphasis there, and it's often hard to translate in English. That's why Rotherham puts those emphasis marks. If you were to look at his translation on these, you'd probably see marks of some sort around those pronouns. Yes?
Is this equated with the fact that in each one of these that the pronoun is right at the first of the sentence to add an emphasis? Or do you see ego, Amy, mixed up behind a bunch of other words in front?
Well, I think there would be a stress on this verb idea with this pronoun, because in each one of these cases, well, in at least the first two cases, the verb follows immediately after the pronoun and it's right there in the first position. So yes, I think there's an additional emphasis on the fact that the verbal idea with its pronoun is coming right away, instead of any split, any words interfering between the two and so forth. There's still going to be an emphasis just by the virtue of the fact that the pronoun is used, regardless of where it's used, what the word order is. But then there's also, because word order... variable, well, the thing that you see first has also got more emphasis. So you might say it's doubly emphatic when you see the verb and the pronoun right together, right at the beginning, and then everything else following. Yes, John?
It's kind of a side point, but not only does that go back to Exodus, but it seems to me it goes back to a large number of verses where the Lord speaks and he says, it's I, he, or I, it's uh-huh. also I, even I, if they translate even I, but it's that same emphasis.
Yes. See, Hebrew has the capability of doing something similar too, because Hebrew also has the verb forms contain the subject idea, and so they can add a pronoun to that also and get more emphasis. And so this is often carried over in the New Testament the same way. Yes. Yeah, Tony.
could you translate it that way? I am.
Well, it's kind of a. I suppose you could, but you would probably have to be careful that the wrong kind of emphasis. Well, you know, it's emphatic, but there's usually in English the kind of emphasis that's seen by this is it comes out as an intonation pattern. That's usually the best. That's probably the best way. But it's often awful hard to translate something with translate an intonation pattern. That's the dilemma Rotherham was in. How am I going to get the emphasis that I can see from the Greek and the Hebrew expressed in English? Well, you might be able to do it with something like that, but it wouldn't always be consistent and it wouldn't always be reflecting exactly what you want. You get a certain feeling for the language after you're in the language and feeling it and so forth, and it just doesn't quite reflect that. The thing that reflects it is, I am, you know. There is a lot more of an emotional type of expression. And so that's what Rotherham chose to do, is use a set of emphatic marks. And after you get used to his system, then you can start reading Rotherham. I think a lot of you will notice reading Rotherham will be different for you now after taking Greek and Hebrew. Those of you who have had it. Yes?
I think that the example of them driving a
traffic. Oh, yes.
Every time I think of the Greeks, you know,
yeah. Oh, that kind of a cultural influence certainly affects the way things are expressed, and you don't know which came first, you know, the ability to express it or the expression or whatever, but they go together, that's for sure. Yes.
How solid is our grounds for making the connection from the New Testament to the Old using? They go, in my mind, more to be kind of a revelatory.
Yes. Well,
is it more stabilized in the grammar?
Well, let's just put it this way. What you can say grammar-wise is this. The form ego eimi is a definitely emphatic form. There's nobody that's going to debate that, because normally if you want to say I am, you just say eimi. And in other words, within the New Testament context, you can see a very definite difference. The whole character of the way the language is constructed shows that you've got a definitely emphatic statement when you say I am. But that's all you could really say from the Greek. Is that it's emphatic. Now, it's not your normal way of saying things. It's calling attention to this expression. Now, the reason for its emphasis, so the reason for its being emphatic, that's where you get into the revelation aspect. And when you have already a context built up in which Yahweh says, I am, the Jews understood, you know, the implications of what he was saying. When he said before Abraham was I am, they took up stones to stone him. See, so they got the message. So that's what I could say is, if you didn't have an Old Testament context, if you didn't have any knowledge of anything else, and you saw ego eimi, you'd know it was emphatic, but you wouldn't necessarily know why.
Do you know if the Septuagint perhaps translated the Old Testament passages where it says I am or anything like that? Translated?
Well, in Exodus 3, where at the burning bush Yahweh says I am that I am, the Septuagint translates it ego eimi ho'on. What they do is they translate the first one, ego eimi, with the emphatic form. And then they translate the second one, even though the Hebrew is the same, it's Eya Asher Eya, it's the same form. They translate the second one, ho'on, with a participle. I don't know why they chose to do that. Maybe they're just trying to cover all, touch all the bases or something.
Actually, then, in order to say that Jews would have very likely understood that expression that Jesus used, you've got enough.
Oh yes, the Septuagint reading would have been, you know, there would have been a connection there. I'm sure there would have been in their minds. Yeah, there's no doubt about that. Okay. Yes, Rick?
Strongest point is, like you're talking to Trinitarians, several of the Trinitarian commentaries state that it refers back to.
Oh, yes, yes. Now, that's not too, and I think even NAS translation gives the footnotes back to Exodus 3 and so forth in some of those places. Oh, no. No, I've seen this in lots of Trinitarian commentaries and so forth. Of course, in their mind, you know, and I saw one book on the Trinity where he claims that it refers back to Jehovah the Old Testament and proves that Jesus is Yahweh the Old Testament. What was that? It's funny. I've got a book called The Trinity by Bickerstaff, and he's an authority on it. Yeah. He's got a whole chapter, Jesus is Yahweh the Old Testament. And he's got the same verses we give in Unfolding Rev class. In fact, I picked up a few more out of his book. And but the strange thing is, you see, the way they're thinking is that Yahweh is the Trinity and Jesus is one of the persons of the Trinity, you see, and they're trying to get this identification that way. In other words, in his mind, he's proving the deity of Jesus Christ. That's what he's thinking of. Yeah. And he's not really stopping to think about persons of the Godhead and so forth at that time. In other words, what happens to these guys is when the anointing's on them, it comes out straight. When they're starting to see it and so forth, yes, it's there, it's clear, and so forth. Same thing happens with Wiest when he covers the Grandville Sharpe's rule. And his section there, he gets really excited about. This proves that Jesus and the Father are one and the same person. I say, yes, amen, brother. Stop and read what you just said, you know. He's really proven the oneness of God, but in his own mind, he's got this Trinitarian idea where they kind of split up their definitions of the terms for a while and then call it a mystery and so you can put it all back together a different way. So. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. Adam Clark, he's got some of the best refutations of the pre-existent Christ doctrine I've ever seen in print. And yet he's a Trinitarian. And you just wonder, how do they handle this in their minds? Well, praise the Lord. if you come up with a revelation of how they do it, I'd like to know. But I suspect that what we're really seeing is that there are spirits involved in this, and there are demons involved, and the confusion that gets in their minds. And yet, because they love God, because they are born again, and they're loving the Lord, when the anointing is there, it comes out straight.
It's just like the cults with their compartmentalization, the mm-hmm. minds where they have just glaring discrepancies, and yet they can't speak.
Sure. Sure. Yeah, and see, the Trinitarian doctrine has a built-in protection for their for them by saying that it's a mystery you can't understand. You've got that built-in thing all the time. So when incongruities show up, we're not troubled by those incongruities because we're taught to expect incongruities. Okay. Yeah, right. It's a revelation. Yeah. All right. But you can see that understanding the Greek here is going to help you a lot in really getting the feeling for it. And especially the second year after we've had all of our grammar, basic grammar, and we start doing translating, that's when you start to feel these emphases, you start to feel why. You'll notice differences, very subtle sometimes, but you'll notice differences in word orders and so forth. You're getting certain a feeling that comes across from that, and you can very accurately and be very confident of the meaning that you're getting across, although there's a certain difficulty in putting that in English and making sure somebody else gets that feeling. Okay. Number two here, the accusative case forms. Oh, he's got a footnote down here. I guess it's just echoing what I said before. Ego, su, himes, and humes could be omitted from these examples without obscuring the sense, since the person of the verb is indicated by the form of the verb itself. Okay, and then we mentioned earlier that the reason to put this there is for one of two reasons, either emphasis or for clarity. And in the case of the first and second persons, it's not so much clarity. It's primarily emphasis, because you're not going to get too confused. Having the pronoun there or not having there is not going to make a whole lot of difference. It's especially it's usually in the case of autos, where you want clarity because, you see, autos has masculine, feminine, neuter forms. Now, the first person and the second person forms don't have masculine, feminine. There's no gender distinction. So the clarity element comes primarily in the autos forms, because a third person verb form doesn't tell you whether it's he, she, or it. So you often need the pronoun to show you whether it's he, she, or it. But if in the first and second person pronoun forms, there's no distinction gender-wise anyway. You wouldn't get any more information by adding ego or su to the verb form. So it's a matter of emphasis more than anything else in these cases. Okay. Point number two, the accusative case forms may serve as direct objects. Notice that the accented and unaccented case forms are interchangeable in this use. So he's claiming that these are interchangeable. The only difference would be slightly one of emphasis, where there's no intrinsic difference in the way that they're used. So you'll see both the accented and unaccented forms in the accusative case. So a few examples, emeu pantote echete, you do not always have me. Okay, ekater, you second person plural, do not always have emeh, me. Accusative case with the accented form. He hamartia, exepate sen me. Okay, sin deceived me. Exepate sen me. Notice we've got two accents now on this verb, exepate sen. Normally we just have the one accent, but because of the enclitic that follows it, we change the accent pattern as we've already discussed. But sin deceived me. So sin is the subject, deceived is a verb, and me is the direct object, and it's the accusative form here. In this case, the enclitic form. Ego se hedoxasa. Okay, I glorified you, or thee, I suppose. You see, one nice thing about King James is that the Old English did have two different words for you. You could say, you know, thou or ye or and so forth, in ye or thee. And you had some ability to make a distinction there. In modern English, you don't. And so it's been streamlined out. But in the Greek, there is a distinction here. This se, of course, would be a singular form. If you wanted a plural form, you'd have humas there. Well, I'm not positive. I assume they're consistent. I assume they're consistent because it's just the way the language was. Okay, in every place I've been able to check it, they have been. Now, there may be problems with texts and so forth. In other words, if they had the right text and this type of thing, there may be some questions there, but I think, as far as I know, they're consistent. Okay, ekbales humas, you are casting us out. It's a lot of words for two words in Greek. But they're all that information is there. See, ekbales, you've got second person singular verb form, and then humas, us, and ekbales, you know, is to cast out. Balos to throw, and ekbalos to throw out. You know, they throw somebody out. So you are casting us out or throwing us out. And the us here is indicated by hemas. Hemas, first person plural, accusative form. Functioning as the direct object here, one who receives the action. Okay, he alalethia eleutherosai humas. The truth will make you free. Okay, again, truth, subject, eleutherosai, to make free, is the verb, and then humas is the direct object in this case, so we need accusative case form. Okay, then the dative case forms may serve as indirect objects. Again, notice that the accented and unaccented forms are interchangeable. So there's no difference between accented and unaccented forms as far as meaning, just emphasis. And you're likely to see both of them in situations like this. So examples, emoi, udepote, edokas, erephone, you never gave me a kid. Okay, it's talking about the prodigal son coming back and so forth and the older son. So emoi, to me. To me, you never gave a kid. In other words, just a literal rendering here. And indirect object with moi here with the accented form. Epen moi panta. He told me everything. Now, in this case, we have the unaccented form. And epen, he told me. Moi is to me and or me everything. Panta. Panta is accusative here. That would be the direct object. But moi is the indirect object. Doso soy. Tas kledas tes basileas tu uranon, ton uranon. I shall give you the keys of the kingdom of the heavens. Okay? I shall give, future form, we really haven't had this verb form, I don't think, yet. Did we have? No, I guess we didn't. Nobody recognizes it. Anyway, this is a future form of the verb to give. Oh, it's a me verb, no wonder we haven't had it yet. Okay, and but that contains the I shall give, and then to you, soy, tas kledas, there's your accusative, the keys. Okay, dienoigen hemin tas graphas, he opened the scriptures to us. Okay, he opened dienoigen, enoigen, remember we had anoigo already. This verb is built from that. This is adding the preposition dia to the front of anoigo. Dia means through, so this kind of means to open through, literally. So it's kind of more of a thorough opening, you might say. It's like he's going through the whole scriptures and opening the whole thing up. is very interesting. You'll see this very frequently with Greek verbs. They will have a verb and then they'll put other prepositions on the verb to give a different nuance to the meaning of it, to amplify it, intensify it, or limit it in some way. Hemin is to us, then, that's the indirect object. And mysterion humin lego, I tell you a mystery. Again, humin to you, indirect object. And then the genitive case forms may modify nouns. When they do so, they may occupy the first attributive position, but not the second, or either of the two predicate positions. Now, this is the same as we saw with autos here in the earlier part of the chapter. The second attributive position is not being used. Only the first attributive and either of the two predicate positions for a genitive form of these personal pronouns. So it's the same situation as we've seen before. First attributive position, hemon oikodome, your edification. So it's the edification of you, in other words, you plural. First predicate position, haute estin hemon hehora, this is your hour. Again, we have hemon hehora, first predicate position, now hemon out in front of the article. And it's noun. Second predicate position, megalune hepsuke mu ton kurion. Now notice here we have second predicate position. That's probably the most common position you'll see. And the enclitic form is probably more common than the other two, and that's what we're seeing here. Okay, the genitive forms may occur with anarthrous nouns. This is exactly the same parallels we saw with autos. But when they do occur with the anarthrous nouns, their translation is a little bit different. Mathe tai mu esta, you are disciples of mine. Yes, when?
Turn back to the second predicate.
Second predicate, okay.
How do you know that that's not the first predicate of tonkurion,
milo? You probably don't. You can see with a genitive form like this, it could be either one. And you have to just kind of run with the context a little bit and decide. In other words, it would be a little bit strange to say, the soul magnifies my Lord. Because the soul, unless the context lets you know what soul you're talking about or something, if you've been talking about some, philosophical idea about the soul, you might, but, yes?
Well, what does contain the megalune? That's
just a third person form. That's just a third-person form, and it doesn't distinguish gender. So it would be possible. Well, let's see. See, hesu ke is nominative. It's got to be the subject of that verb. And you couldn't do too much more with that. The only problem would be which one does the mu modify. That wouldn't give you any more information. You know that soul is a subject of the verb, and it's a third-person singular verb form. But what you don't know necessarily is whether mu modifies hesu ke in the second predicate position, or whether it modifies ton kurion in the first predicate position.
Then you just go into context, and you know that she's she's speaking, and so therefore it must be her soul. Mm-hmm. What she'd be saying,
right?
She'd be saying her soul magnifies my Lord.
Now, in other words, it's very unusual for a person to say about himself, the soul magnifies my Lord, and I guess now you can't really go by this because these things do occur in first predicate positions, but more common than not, they're going to occur in second predicate positions. And if they occur in first predicate positions, I don't know if you can really make this as a rule, but I would expect to see them. In other words, when you find an ambiguous situation like this, I would be inclined to first look at the second predicate position rendering. That's going to be the most likely one. And if that makes sense, then you probably don't need to go further. And the other one probably isn't going to make as much sense. And if they use a first predicate position, it's usually when there's not another thing in front of it to confuse it. For example, if you look at the previous example, you had a verb form, estin, in front of humon there, so you wouldn't have any problem getting that confused. So I think that's probably what they're going to do. It'd be interesting. Maybe we can kind of watch when we're translating to see if we find, watch for potential ambiguities like this and see if they are not always lining up as second predicate position when there's potential ambiguity. So you get a feeling after a while, second predicate position is the most common position. And so if you kind of keep that in mind, then it'll usually solve this problem for you. And but bear in mind that there could be some ambiguity in some cases. You're going to have to look at context and make a decision on that basis. Now, Greek does not free us from all ambiguities. It's got fewer ambiguities than English, but it does not free us from all of them. And this genitive usage, genitives, I think, are probably, as a group, the area where you're going to find the most ambiguities, not only in terms of things like the syntax of which the genitive applies to, but in terms of things like what the genitive means in a particular case. That's the kind of thing we'll be exploring in the second year more. Okay. We've got 5 more minutes here. Maybe we can finish this one section before we get to these possessive adjectives. Genitive forms may occur with anarthrous nouns. When they do, then your translation is a little bit different. It's just like with autos. If it's an anarthrous noun, then, for example, mathe taimu esta, you are disciples of mine, rather than you are my disciples. And if it was you are my disciples, then you'd have the article on mathe tai, vihoi mathe taimu esta. Notice, too, just by virtue of these accent rules, we have two enclitics in a row here with mu esta, and mu got the accent now because, remember, when you have more than one enclitic in a row, they all get the accent except the last one. Okay, then part E. If the noun modified has an adjective in the first attributive position, the genitive case form of the pronoun comes between the adjective and the noun. Okay, so this is these are more refinement here with regard to these pronouns. They like to get close to the noun. That's kind of the way to think of it. They like to stay close to the noun. And so if the noun's got another adjective on it, say in the first predicate position, then the pronoun is going to come after the adjective but before the noun, right between the adjective and the noun. Look at the example. Ho palaios hemon anthropos. Okay, our old man. You get our word paleontology and so we're talking about palaios, ancient, you see. So our fossil man here, old man. But you see, hemon comes right after the adjective but before the noun. When the noun's in the first predicate, first attributive position, excuse me. So if you can think of it, the way I like to remember this is that the pronoun likes to get right close to the noun, whether it's before or after. Look at the second in the second attributive position, this holds true as well. If the noun modified has an adjective in the second attributive position, the genitive case form of the pronoun comes after the noun preceding the article of the adjective. So it'll come right close to the noun, you see, before the article of the adjective. Look at the example here. Su e ho huyos mu ho agape tos. You are my beloved son. Okay, su e ho huyos mu. Now our phrase now that we're interested in is ho huyos mu ho agape tos. Ho agape tos is in a attributive position, second attributive position to the noun ho huyos. But the mu comes right before the adjective. It's not ho huyos ho agape tos mu. It's rather ho huyos mu ho agape tos. So these personal pronouns like to get right as close to that noun as they can, on one side or the other, even if there's other adjectives. The adjectives kind of get shoved aside and this thing gets put real close to it. So that's like the way I like to remember it. Yes, did you have a question to anybody? Okay. Then, yes, Glenn.
Would you ever see the move in the first attributive in this kind of thing? Because you have a first attributive.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Right, and the first attributive is if it's with something else in the second attributive.
Are you saying that if you want to put the mu in the first
attributive, has an adjective in the second attributive
right.
position, would you ever see the pronoun in the first attributive to the noun?
Oh, I see what you're saying. It's a little hard to interpret from this. The rule-wise, it wouldn't seem there'd be any problem with it. With other adjectives, you can put some in the first and some in the second. That's a good question. I don't know if we just have to check and see if it ever occurs that way. I'm inclined to think that since he takes the time to mention it like this, this is the way you're going to see it. If it's got an adjective in the second attributive position, then that seems to be the qualifier. If it's got an adjective in the second attributive position, then the genitive case form of the pronoun comes after the noun preceding the article. So it's I think that would probably be, at least but interpreting what he's saying here, that'd be the case. I can't, you know, it's hard to think off the top of your head of all the examples in the New Testament. So I don't want to sign it in blood and say that this is the way it is. But I'd be inclined to say that this is the way you are going to see it. Because for one thing, mu there, you'd probably see an emphatic form if you stuck it in that other position anyway. Ho, mu, huyos, I'm inclined to doubt that you'd see it that way. Generally, you're going to see the thing afterwards anyway. It's usually when you've got another adjective, you see, in front of the thing in first attributive position, that you're going to get this mu perhaps even before. But it usually has a tendency to come afterwards. So I guess you can, as far as translating is concerned, as far as if you're ever asked to translate something from English to Greek, use this format here. I think that'd be the safest way to go. And we'll just have to keep our eyes open to see if we ever see it in any other way. I sure can't think of any. Okay, number G, the emphatic form emu is not used to modify nouns except when it is joined to another pronoun. Okay, so when you're modifying nouns, you always use the enclitic form mu rather than emu, except when it's joined with another pronoun. In other words, if you've got a compound pronoun situation, it doesn't occur very often. But here we have greet Rufus and his mother and mine. Kai tain metera autu kai emu. His and mine. See, autu kai emu. Now emu is joined by kai with another pronoun, autu. And in that case, you may see the emphatic form with the article. I mean, with the accent. But you won't normally see it modifying a noun. You'll see mu modifying a noun. Okay. For next time, we didn't quite finish this chapter, so let me take a look here at lesson 15. We'll give you part of that to do. It's a rather long lesson, so let's see. We can do 15A with no problem. 15B. 15C. And I think we'll hold on D and E and F. Oh, I guess we got E, F, G. We've got a lot of them here. None of these using the adjective. Okay, 15D we can do. And we can do E also. All right, let's do 15, A, B, C, D, and E for next time, next Tuesday. And don't worry about F and G, F, G, and H. We'll do those later because that deals with the adjectives. Okay, 15A through E.